So effectively the way it works here at the port is that a vessel will arrive, and about 4 nautical miles offshore, a pilot, and the pilots are run by the state government through the Port Authority of New South Wales, a pilot will board the ship and it will bring the ship into port. It will then dock the ship against the berth of one of these stevedoring terminals or the bulk liquids berth.
At that point, this is Marika Kalfas, the Chief Executive of NSW Ports, the company that runs Port Botany in Sydney and Port Kembla in the Illawarra. I'm Richard Adie, and I'm in her office, well, outside her office, because on the money today, we're talking ports.
Ports are the largest freight hubs in the country.
David Anderson's the CEO of industry group Ports Australia.
They're not just places where ships park, which is sometimes the way people think of them. They are the facilitators of an enormous amount of trade, of course, between maritime transport and road and rail. Apart from anything else, Australia is a highly exposed, trade-exposed country by OECD standards. Something like the value of trade that goes across our ports equates to about a third of our GDP, so let's say $500 billion in round terms. $1.2 billion worth of trade goes across our ports every day of the week. So to say our community is dependent on our ports for their standard of living and for consumer choice and other things, of course, that's a key element in their role.
Essentially, there's three types of ports.
Firstly, we have our very large resource ports that are very export orientated, naturally enough. That is mainly coal and iron ore, but not exclusively so. We do a lot of bauxite and other commodities of that sort. And they are involved in very large tonnages. For example, Pilbara Ports will be doing something approaching 700 million tonnes of iron ore just this year.
I think Port Hedland and Dampier are among the biggest ports in the world in terms of tonnage.
Well, they are. They most certainly are. In terms of export of iron ore, they're the largest. Pilbara Ports is a combination of Dampier and Hedland. So between them, they're moving very substantial quantities. Newcastle Port is the largest coal exporting port in the world. They do about 160 million tonnes. So that's one category that's very important to our economy and our export earnings. And in terms of tonnage, is responsible for a very high proportion of the total tonnage that goes across our wharves every year. The second category are our large, mainly city-based container ports, which are much more import-orientated. We actually have a large imbalance between our import and export containers, largely because we, of course, import much of our consumables, many of our consumables, whether they be white goods or mobile phones or computers and what have you. And they serve the large urban conurbations with whom they coexist. And the third category is what I describe as smaller, but nevertheless very important, smaller regional multi-purpose ports that do in some respects sometimes specialise in particular commodities. Port of Portland in Victoria, for example, is now the largest wood chip exporting port in the Southern Hemisphere. So you have ports like Geraldton, Esperance, Albany, Portland, Tasports, of course, which are very important to their regional economies and fulfil very important regional roles.
Port Botany is in that second group.
We're standing at the head of Brotherson Dock, and in front of you is our main dock. On the left is the container terminal operated by DP World, and on the right-hand side is the container terminal operated by Patrick's. In the distance, there's Blue Cranes. That's a container terminal operated by Hutchison. What we have right in front of us are tugs, and they're operated by Svitzer. These are the vessels that take the ships in and out of the port from a safety perspective. And around the corner, which you can't see right now, is our bulk liquids facility and two bulk liquids berths. And we've got in front of us a healthy number of container ships, all looking to discharge and load containers today.
So what's coming in?
We handle two types of trades here. We handle bulk liquids and we handle containers. Container-wise, we're handling 2.3 to 2.4 million TEUs. TEUs are 20-foot equivalent units. That's what it stands for. So they're 20-foot boxes. Much of the goods come in 40-foot boxes, which is therefore two TEUs. In terms of bulk liquids, what we handle is about 5 billion litres of liquids per annum. Those liquids range. We have actually here the largest common user bulk liquids facility in Australia. What we have is we handle 100% of the state's bitumen supply. 98% of the state's consumption of LPG comes through this port, and that's contained in a cavern 150 metres underground. 90% of all bulk chemicals for the port also come through this port, and they're used in manufacturing. And 30% of refined fuel products, including fuel for Sydney Airport, and there's a direct pipeline connection from the port to Sydney Airport. So we have two really critical types of trades through this port.
How much does all that add up to?
From a trade perspective, we handle about $61 billion of goods through the port. From a port perspective, we contribute about $4 billion to the state's economy, and also around about 21,000 jobs here at the port. And you can work it out, a rule of thumb, we have 1,400 vessels that visit the port every year, so each vessel's bringing around $2.2 million to the economy.
I'm Richard Aidy. Today on The Money, we're looking at the conduits through which we do the importing and exporting of goods, ports. Peter van Doorn's spent much of his working life in them. These days he's at the Centre for Supply Chain and Logistics at Deakin University, but he spent 25 years in shipping and stevedoring, which is getting the cargo on and off the vessels. Peter, what are the different ownership structures for ports?
Well, there's a number of different structures. There's just the landlord model, and there's the whole of port model, where the owner of the port runs the whole show, including the stevedoring, the providing of tugs, harbour master services, owns the channel that leads into the port. Or there's, like I said, the landlord, where it's just basically the owner is a landlord function, where they just lease out slabs of land to private companies, mainly private companies, that operate in the port. The ownership is then divided by, can it be owned by a private company, or can it be owned by local government or state government, or even the city, like a city of Rotterdam owns the port of Rotterdam.
But Michael Bell, the Foundation Professor of Ports and Maritime Logistics at Sydney University, says one model dominates the market.
Most ports around the world are following the landlord model, which means that there's a separation between the terminal operator and the landlord for the port. And that model has been implemented in Australia in a slightly different variation. In most cases, the port is either in public hands or it's been corporatised in the form of a public corporation, but in New South Wales we've had the privatisation of the landlord in the form of NSW Ports. But nonetheless, there's still this separation between the landlord, who's responsible for the infrastructure, and competing terminal operators. And in the case of Sydney, there's three of them, and in the case of Melbourne, there's three of them, and in Brisbane, there's three of them. Seems to go in threes. But that model seems to be working very well. It keeps the operation of the container terminal efficient, and clearly each operator has their own set of clients and their own specialities. So it's a good system.
And it's exactly the system that NSW Ports uses.
We are a landlord. We also have some level of operating roles. We manage the bulk liquids berths. So we tend to manage those berths where they're common user, where multiple users come and go from those berths. We have berths in Port Kembla, which are also common users that we manage. We're responsible for the security around the port, and we're responsible for the infrastructure and also provision of infrastructure where we need to provide more to provide capacity in the system.
Peter van Doorn has reservations about ports that aren't publicly owned.
A port, because it's such an important driver for the state or for even for the country in some ports, is it should not be in private hands. And if it is, it should have a good regulatory overlay. Because ports are almost in a monopoly position. Yeah, like, for instance, in Melbourne or in Sydney, most of the goods, and I'm talking about a lot of containers now, end up quite close to the port. So it's not that you can say, okay, well, prices are getting too high in Melbourne, I'll go through Sydney and I'll ship my stuff through Sydney. But by doing that, you become uncompetitive, because by the time you got your goods down from Sydney to Melbourne by truck or road or rail, it becomes uncompetitive. So you're more or less forced to go to Melbourne to discharge or load your goods. So that's an issue, I think, having a monopoly position.
And that's not his only concern.
A private company, their main concern is having a return on investment to their shareholders. So they would try and sweat the assets as much as possible. And I think in some cases they leave renewal or expansion too long, because in a lot of cases they've paid a very high price. And so they want to get, obviously, return on that investment. And that's happened in case the UK, where in the Thatcher years a lot of the ports were privatised, and they had an investment for a long time. So they lost business, and that business could go somewhere else. In this case, a lot of it went to like places like Rotterdam or Antwerp or Hamburg. And then it was very hard to get that business back. They now are expanding, but the issue is that they've got different drivers. Like, for instance, a state-owned port might have a driver of economic prosperity, job prospects and things like that, while a private owner obviously has different drivers.
But Peter, isn't there good oversight of our privatised ports?
The one in Melbourne is because they learned from previous mistakes. In Melbourne, it's reasonably good. In other ports, for Brisbane and Sydney, it's been a bit more lax. And for instance, in the case of Sydney, there's even a compensation clause that if a competing container terminal set up in Newcastle, that the owner, the present owner of the Sydney or Port Botany and port would get compensation. So, so that obviously doesn't bode well for the Port of Newcastle if they ever wanted to set up a competing container terminal.
This came out in the middle of last year, 3 years after the New South Wales government privatised Port Botany and Port Kembla. Simply put, once Newcastle passes a threshold, 30,000 containers a year, it would have to pay about $100 for each container it handles. That money would go to the government and then to NSW Ports. At the moment, it has to be said, Newcastle isn't close to moving 30,000 containers a year. This is The Money on RN, the ABC radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Ady. Today, we're looking at ports, which it turns out are increasingly automated.
Well, this is a success story for Australia, really. There's basically the automation of straddle carriers, first of all introduced in Brisbane and more recently in Sydney, with technology that was developed in conjunction with Sydney University and Kalmar, which is a Swedish engineering company.
So what are we talking about here?
So these are driverless vehicles. The great thing about ports is that they're way ahead of the rest of the world in terms of driverless vehicles. So there's a lot of noise at the moment about driverless cars, but driverless vehicles have been in operation in ports for some time now.
What does a straddle carrier do?
Right. Well, a straddle carrier is a very odd-looking beast. It's one container wide with six wheels or possibly eight. And essentially it slides across the top of a container and lifts it from the top. And they're very tall, so they can lift one container over two or possibly over three.
Another key development, according to Michael Bell, is that ports are becoming greener.
Ports can be made much cleaner than they currently are, and the key to that is electrification. And as far as moving objects are concerned, the key to that is batteries. So I think it is definitely the next step. And I believe the next generation of autostrads being introduced in Los Angeles are battery driven. So that's one step. Of course, they're only zero emission if you source the electricity from a zero emission producer, but it's a necessary step to get towards zero emission.
Because the advantage of doing it this way is that you don't have any emissions on site. And actually, the battery-powered vehicles don't really make much noise either.
That's a big thing. Yeah, they don't make as much noise as revving diesel engines. And, of course, there's no fumes. It's generally a very nice technology.
Speaking of technology, they're also using data in clever ways.
International trade is very data-intensive. And there are a number of stakeholders involved. And up until recent times, it's been paper-based, and it has involved a lot of rekeying of data. But there has been a move to systems called port community systems, which are essentially a big database which holds all the necessary data. But of course, a lot of that data is commercially sensitive, so access to it has to be on a need-to-know basis. And so there's a lot of development going on there, essentially extending automation from the robots to data handling. And it extends, for example, to gate control and the ability to actually automate gates. Gates are where trucks enter and leave a port. And so with devices, transponders, or e-tags of one kind or another, it's possible to automate that as well. So that becomes a process without manual intervention.
And taking out the human element confers a couple of advantages.
Saves a lot of time, and perhaps even more importantly, it cuts out errors from rekeying. So, you know, someone gets a digit wrong with a container number or something like that, can cause an awful lot of problems and waste time in trying to correct it later. So it's really about, I think, more about reliability than anything else.
Ports don't exist in isolation. Historically, cities have grown up around them. Ports have neighbours. Those neighbours have opinions, and they compete for land. Which gets us to a fundamental issue, connecting the port to the rest of the country. David Anderson from Ports Australia.
Over the last 5 to 10 years, we have undergone very substantial increases in capacity port side at both our bulk freight ports and our container ports. To be matched by the landside capacity, that is the road and rail corridors and the way in which those corridors are managed, is imperative for that investment, the benefits of that investment portside to be fully realised. And the big challenge for us is driving understanding both with our politicians and our communities that those corridors need to be protected, and indeed there needs to be capacity for growth. And that doesn't just go to the provision of infrastructure, it goes to how that infrastructure is managed, and it goes to our planning regimes, because land use conflicts around our ports is also becoming an increasingly difficult issue to deal with. The appetite of Australians to now occupy apartments with sea views is in part responsible for that. But also the appetite for local councils for the developers' dollars and so on does give us quite significant issues, because over time, these conflicts, unless better managed, will impede the activities of ports.
Marika Kaufas, who runs the port in the middle of our largest city, is right at the pointy end of this.
There has to be sufficient capacity in the road and the rail network to be able to get the boxes and get the bulk liquids away from the port to the hinterland, to the customer. And that is, with Sydney's increasing urban congestion and traffic congestion, you know, that is only going to prove more challenging with time. The other part of the puzzle is then land use planning. And over time, the industrial lands surrounding the port at Botany and other ports shrinks. And it gets to a point where actually then you find yourself operating in quite a constrained urban environment. So the nearest residence to Port Botany at the moment is 200 metres away. But you can actually hear noise from the port up to 2 kilometres away. So this is the challenge that needs to be balanced in this state.
I don't have to tell you that this is difficult. What you mightn't know is the timeframes that ports try to plan for.
We released at the end of 2015 a 30-year master plan. And there's probably not many businesses that do 30-year master plans. But the infrastructure that we have to provide has very long lead times. The infrastructure that gets built has lives of 100-year plus on their asset lives. So we need to look at that. Now, our master plan looks at what is the likely trade growth over 30 years, and then what is the infrastructure and the activities and decisions that need to be made to support that growth. Over a 30-year period, we are suggesting that there could be a tripling of container volumes. There could be a doubling of bulk liquid volumes. And all of those things, therefore, need other parts of the supply chain to also keep up with those volumes.
Most of the volume for our capital city container ports is moved by road, so trucks. There are lots of them. They're big, and they will probably get bigger.
On the roadside, there is an argument, if you look at it in pure economic terms, for using larger vehicles or higher productivity trucks on the roads through to ports. They're bigger trucks. The community, as a rule, doesn't like them, and it needs a lot of education to bring them around to the idea that they're actually safe and can be utilised on the approaches to ports. But importantly, particularly for our container ports, we've got to do much better with rail. At the moment, at any of our container ports, we're not doing any better, I think it's than 15 or 16% of the container task being carried by rail. So if you look at a port like Botany, let's say Botany is doing around 2.5 million containers per year at the moment and has got a theoretical capacity of 7 or 8 million TEUs. We've obviously got to do a lot better with rail to manage that task going forward.
The objective is to put more on rail so that you reduce the growth of truck volumes. And the approximate numbers are for every 1 million TEUs you can put on rail, you'll reduce the number of trucks at Port Botany by 900 trucks per day. So it's quite a significant reduction. Now, our target at NSW Ports in terms of rail, in order to make sure we can support the volume needs for the state, is we would like to see 3 million TEUs on rail over the next 30 years. At the moment, the numbers are around about 360,000 TEUs per year, but it has seen growth in the recent couple of years, which is fantastic. Now, with the opening of Enfield, with the future opening of Moorebank, all of those intermodal terminals are part of the solution, because you need intermodal terminal capacity in order to take the boxes from the port. You can't just rail them out without having that intermodal capacity. But beyond Moorebank, there will actually be a need for more intermodals and more rail in order to actually get to that 3 million TEUs. And it is about creating efficient supply chains and getting trucks off roads as well.
Marika mentions Enfield. It's what's called an intermodal terminal, so containers can be put directly onto trains inside the port, then moved to Enfield for warehousing and distribution. Another is planned further out of Sydney, at Moorebank. Additional rail infrastructure is expensive with high upfront costs, but Peter Van Doan says that's the wrong way to look at it.
Once you put that infrastructure in, it is the rail, you know, rail infrastructure. It's there for a long time. And the other thing is, and this has been the beef of the rail operators, is that we, as the general public, fund a lot of those roads, or it's either tolled, and we pay tolling fees, and the big heavy trucks who do most of the damage use it. And at currently, the pricing regime is not efficient, and there are thoughts about changing that, where they're looking at this pricing per kilometre travelled and how heavy the vehicle is. Like if it's a 50-ton truck and it drives for 100 kilometres, it gets charged accordingly. It's called according to mass limits. They have GPS in the truck so they can measure it all, and they do that in Europe. So that would be a more equitable way of pricing road transport, and then by doing that, you would make rail transport more competitive.
Ports are vital, of course they are, but most of us know little about them, and we don't really connect them with export earnings or the stuff we buy in the shops. David Anderson.
It's really interesting, actually, if you look at some of the European ports, there's a very close cultural connection, which is in part historical, between the community and their ports, and a respect for the port and its license to operate and to grow. In Australia, that culture is not so evident, even though, ironically, in a sense, we're surrounded by water and we're a very large island. If you look at areas like Williamstown in Melbourne or Balmain in Sydney, where at one stage they were, if you like, occupied by portside workers in houses and cottages who had a very close cultural connection with the port, that problem didn't exist. Now, of course, these areas, and Fremantle's another good example, now these areas are becoming gentrified, I think, is the word that's often used. There isn't that connection and a growing intolerance of noise and other disturbance caused by ports.
There's another problem too, though it's really the port's customers' problem rather than the ports themselves. Overcapacity. There's too many container ships.
There are strong headwinds for shipping. And I think this of course, applies to ports as well, because if shipping is not growing at the rate that it was before the global financial crisis, then, of course, port throughput won't grow at the rate that it was before. So I think there are going to have to be long-term adjustments to views of ever-increasing growth. I think that's possibly the challenge for the next, let's say, 5 years, adjusting expectations and getting actual trade volumes in line with capacity.
Actually, the shipping sector might just have turned the corner. Global shipping rates are predicted to increase this year after 4 years of going down. Michael Bell, though, can see other challenges.
Taking a long-term view, one of the challenges relates to what's going to happen to international trade, because we see the progressive miniaturization of devices, which means you can get more of them into one container. We see, with automation in production, we see the possibility to make things in high-cost consuming countries, which before, well, might not have been economical to do. And of course, if you're customizing, it's good to be close to the consumer. So I think what we're going to see is essentially a shrinking of supply chains. Nothing dramatic. I mean, this is a gradual process and it won't apply to everything, but it will apply to enough to affect international trade volumes, I think.
That's a way down the line. David Anderson finishes in his role at Ports Australia this autumn. He's optimistic about the future.
It's about the whole engagement with community. It's about committing yourself to particular environmental values and so on, so that you're describing your aspirations in a total package to the community that hopefully leads to a better understanding of what we do and why it's imperative that we have the room to grow. I mean, the BITRE, the Bureau in Canberra, tells us that our container traffic will double by about the year 2030, which isn't that far away. And even though the long-term growth rate in our container traffic has edged back a bit to 4 to 5% year by year, that's still a very robust growth.
Thanks to David Anderson from Ports Australia, Professor Michael Bell from the University of Sydney, Peter Van Doen, who's at Deakin University, and Marika Kalfas of NSW Ports. You can find out more on our homepage, abc.net.au/rn. If you're listening to The Money as a podcast, please rate or review the show. It helps other people find it. The Money is produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. And I'm Richard Ady.
This Is About is a podcast hosted by Jordan Raskopoulos. That's me. Stories told by those who live them.
To do a good job, you kind of have to believe that you're Spider-Man.
He was holding what he claimed was Ned Kelly's skull.
She just said to me, if you can't have this baby, I'll have a baby for you.
What I thought was two different dolphins was just one shark.
What?
This Is About on the ABC Radio app or wherever you get your favourite podcasts.
Listen now.
On your phone.
You know, just do the thumb thing.